session number 11127, rule 4.
Inevitably, large numbers died from disease because they weren't used to that sort of thing. And can you imagine anything less likely to win the hearts and minds of Aborigines than to forcibly resettle them in some camp? And there were occasions too in 1953 and I think 54 where bombing was carried out of areas of jungle, not certainly intentionally into areas occupied by Aborigines, but in areas adjacent to Aborigines. And bombing the jungle was very counterproductive. It played into terrorist hands in the sense that they were able to say to the Aborigines, look, the British imperialists are dropping bombs and trying to kill you from the air. And I'm happy to say that those lessons, I think, were learnt in Malaya, and there was no bombing in Malaya after the middle 50s, unless possibly on a definitely identified target. And the lesson, very importantly, was learnt in Borneo, where there was absolutely no air action at any part of Borneo which could have affected the indigenous population. So the successes took place slowly and bit by bit, and kills were made, but the main success was that the Aborigines gradually came to support the government.
I'd like you just to talk a little bit about
the whole question of cooperation with Aborigines in primitive countries is one which I find fascinating. I myself was never any good at it. My Malay was always rudimentary, and somehow I never had the sort of personality that encouraged laughs and jokes with Aborigines. There were other officers in the SAS, notably John Salmon and John Cooper, who had this knack of being able to make Aborigines giggle and laugh and feel at home, and there were many soldiers with the same ability. And to have the right personality to deal with Aborigines was awfully important. Certainly I lacked it completely. But there were individuals, of course, in my squadron who were very good. And it was that sort of personal relationship, which could only, of course, be achieved by people who spoke Malay reasonably well, talking to Aborigines who spoke Malay. And it was, I think, the personal contact, and you might almost describe the sort of jolly personal friendship that achieved this. And there again, Calvert's teaching that you had to stay in the deep jungle not just for months but for years, and there were areas of Malaya in the north where SAS squadron succeeded SAS squadron, and you came back for a second and third and even a fourth time into that area, and of course you were greeted eventually as old friends. And it was this final development of Calvert's theories that eventually brought success.
Were you doctoring by then? Had you had to?
The medical side was certainly better.
Sorry, my voice came over.
The importance of medical treatment is obvious in these cases. In the 50s in Malaya, the training of the medical orderlies was fairly rudimentary. There were no long medical courses, let alone courses in treating gunshot wounds and so on. Which the regiment developed after its visit to the United States in 1962. At the time, a great deal of publicity was given to parachuting by the SAS, parachuting into trees in the jungle. This all arose because the first parachute operation was in the extreme north of the country in the beginning of 1952. When B Squadron, who were the only trained parachutists in the regiment at the time, jumped into the valley of the Bloom River. And two or three of them got hooked up in trees on the edge of the clearing they jumped into. And this had been foreseen, and they had been provided with ropes, and they came down the ropes. A great deal of effort was spent over the next 3 or 4 years in developing an ability to parachute into the trees and then to come down through the trees, which in the jungle, of course, can be as high as 200 feet above the ground. There were a number of deaths and an even larger number of injuries in this training. And though there were occasions, in 1956, for example, I dropped one patrol by parachute into a remote area of jungle because there were no clearings and they couldn't get into that area any other way quickly and without being heard or seen on the ground. But generally speaking, parachuting, which was so emphasized in the early 50s, became redundant because helicopters came into use gradually. In 1951, there were only three little Sycamore helicopters in the whole of Malaya. But by the mid-1950s, we were carried in whirlwind helicopters by the RAF and the Royal Navy, and the whole necessity for parachuting in a relatively small country like Malaya, which was only 400 or 500 miles long and could be reached easily by helicopter from anywhere, the necessity for parachuting had really almost disappeared. At the end of my tour with 22 SAS in Malaya in 1957, I was posted to 21 SAS regiment, the territorial regiment in London. I was the regular second-in-command to a commanding officer, Colonel David Sutherland, who had been a very prominent and distinguished member of the SBS in the war. In 21 SAS, my main responsibility was training, and of course this training was, by that time, designed for operations in Germany in the event of a war against the Soviet Union. And the training was obviously totally different to counter-terrorist roles in Malaya, and I was given the very interesting task of developing this training with 21 SAS. And incidentally, it was obvious to me the war in Malaya was coming to an end, and the question of the survival of 22 SAS was of the greatest possible interest to me and everyone else in the SAS, and therefore I was very pleased and very fortunate to serve in 21 SAS and to learn something of European roles which might perhaps be passed on and 22 SAS might well become involved in once the Malayan emergency had finished.
Please, repeat that again.
In 1957, in 21 SAS, I was perhaps a little surprised when I came and asked what the regiment's role would be in the event of war, to be told that, in effect, that there were no plans for the operation of the regiment in a major or, for that matter, a minor war. While a bit surprised, this also, of course, gave me and the commanding officer a great deal of scope because we could exercise our imaginations and decide for ourselves what possible roles we might fit into in the event of a war. And we discussed the problems of fighting a nuclear war, which at that time was considered a feasible military and political fact of life, and we exercised considerably in the possibility of acquiring targets for nuclear weapons, and we exercised also in the traditional roles that the wartime SAS had of encouraging and supporting operations behind enemy lines.
In places like North.
The enemy in Malaya, the enemy were communist and were terrorists. The majority happened to be Chinese communist terrorists, but there were a few Malays as well. I'd naturally had read a good deal about communism, both at Cambridge when I was learning Russian and in Malaya, in order to try and study and understand the enemy. And I could well understand the appeal of communism as a possible solution to the problems of poverty, disease, exploitation, and so on in various countries in the world. It never had the slightest sympathy from me, in the sense that we were in British governed territory, and whatever its failings, we knew in the 1950s the British policy was to grant independence in due course to the colonies and protected territories in the Commonwealth. We also knew from very obvious and bitter experiences that terrorism meant terrorism, and there were many cases of women and children not only being murdered but being tortured before murder in Malaya. Therefore, we could have had and did have no sympathy with communist terrorists. That is not to say that we considered the enemy there as a sort of subhuman in a Germanic sense at all. And at a very early stage, Calvert demonstrated visibly and what our attitude should be to those people, of whom there are always some in every nation, who think that the answer to getting information is torture. And so vividly I remember this early occasion in, I think, 1950, when a police officer was visiting us in the officers' mess in Malaya, and he started talking about how to get information out of terrorists, which included burning them with cigarette ends and other unpleasantness. And Calvert grew silence, and I watched the volcano in him about to erupt, and in due course it did erupt when he said, "Is that what you really think?" And the man said, "Yes, yes, that's the answer." And without further word, Calvert picked him up by one arm and swung him and slung him straight out of the room. And when he dusted his hands and sat down, he asked us why we thought that he'd done it. And after we dithered and harbored, waffled away, he said, "Well, I'm going to tell you a story now about my Chindit days. And when I was in the Chindits, we picked up a Karen who had been reporting our positions to the Japanese, and we knew he had. And I said to him, 'What do you expect to happen to you now? You've been helping the Japanese.' And he wouldn't answer. See, I said, 'What would the Japanese have done to you if you'd been helping us against them?' And he said, 'They would kill me.' So Calvert said to him, 'And what do you expect we shall do?' And he said, 'Well, I suppose you will kill me.' So he said, 'That's where you're wrong. And if you want to know why you're wrong, it's because in the British Empire, we don't need to behave like that, and we don't behave like that. We shall win this war, and you have been misguided in trying to help the Japanese, and I'm going to set you free,' which he thereupon did, asking me only to promise not to support the Japanese and help the Japanese anymore. But whether he did or didn't help the Japanese again, I don't know. And Calvert asked us why he thought he had taken this action, and he explained to us that in fact the reason that he had done this was because had that man been shot, he had a family, and the family would have hated the British forevermore, whatever the reason for the shooting. Whereas having released him, he would say what Calvert had said to him, and whether or not they believed it, that family would be grateful to the British ever after. And that lesson too rather sunk home to me, because there's always an attitude amongst young men, particularly young soldiers, and I could remember it from the war. I could remember an occasion where very early in my war service, when we retook a hill in Tunisia, and there were three German soldiers left on that hill who surrendered to us. And the Germans, it was a place called Fort McGregor near Medjez el Bab in February 1943, and the Germans had stormed and captured this hill the previous day, and the company of our battalion, the Hussars that was on it, was wiped out. And there were many of their comrades on this hill, and my company's comrades on this hill, who were dead, lying around on the hill. And when these three soldiers, German soldiers, surrendered the next morning when my platoon reoccupied the hill, we lined them up against, it happened to be, against the face of a rock, having disarmed them. And I was simply reported I had three prisoners and waiting for them to be picked up. But the muttering began behind me, shoot the bastards, the murdering fucking bastards, kill them. And of course, whoever started this, the word started spreading. And though probably the Germans didn't understand English, they certainly understood the mood, and they were going white and shivering and so on. And I remembered at the time thinking, yes, that's rather what I'd like to do, but of course we don't kill prisoners, do we? And I said to myself, and the whole thing obviously blew over. But later on, against terrorists, one perhaps might have been tempted to use force to get information, but I always remembered Calvert's words, and I believe that the SAS have remembered them ever since, because every SAS soldier is taught that that is not the way to behave. And indeed Calvert's remark, I think, is very relevant, because wars don't end forever just when the shooting stops. The result of wars goes on for generations.
Colonel John Woodhouse, tape 4.
So the enemy in Malaya was a communist and a terrorist. They were badly equipped and not very well trained. The things they were good at was evasion, and to some extent they were successful in political indoctrination. Certainly in the early days they had quite widespread support, and control of the Aborigines, of course, in the early days was nearly total. But as a fighting enemy they were not formidable, and the policy always, if faced by them, even when there were only three men, which normally were only three or four men in our patrol, was always to attack regardless of what strength they might be in. And this policy was thoroughly justified, because for their own reasons, as well as their lack of weaponry to some extent, and lack of training, they always, or almost always, broke off a fight. So tactics were pretty simple, and tactical action was simple, in that it must always be offensive, almost regardless of the situation. In Borneo, the situation was rather different. Because there the initial revolt was by very poorly equipped individuals in Brunei. Later the enemy was the regular armed forces of Indonesia. It included units, some of whose officers had been trained in the United States by the US Special Forces, and they were very well armed, and they were usually militarily, certainly reasonably efficient. And there, different tactics had to be applied. They were not a communist enemy. And in the main, I suppose one can say they were not a terrorist enemy, though terrorism would have come quite easily to them, and they had nothing against it in principle, so to speak. But we were really fighting a nationalist enemy aiming to expand Indonesia, and one never had the slightest feeling that there was any excuse or justification for it, and therefore there could be no sympathy at all with the aims of the Indonesians.
Can I ask you,
my impression when I first went to Borneo was that the whole thing would be likely to fizzle out. This was really on the grounds that it seemed to me inconceivable that Indonesia would wish to escalate a war which nominally was against Malaysia, but in practice was against the armed forces of Great Britain. It was inconceivable to me that they would wish to escalate such a war, because it was inconceivable to me that they could ever win it. They couldn't have command of the sea, they couldn't have command of the air. Borneo anyway was an island, and the more they escalated it, the less likely it was that they would come out of it without very serious damage. In fact, and up to a point, I was proved wrong in the sense that they did escalate it on land, and even attempted to escalate it by parachute drop into Malaya, which miscarried very badly. And it reached the stage where the V-bombers squadron was flown to Singapore and naval reinforcements came out. However, they continued to attempt to invade the Malaysian part of Borneo, but never at any time did they show the slightest prospect of success. They just showed that they might have heavier casualties.
So you had never had any feeling that this was a situation that you weren't going to that you were going to not lose, but perhaps not be able to satisfactorily win. What was were there the problems of logistics and so on? Were they so frustrating that you didn't think you would be able to get on top?
The war was perhaps not winnable in the sense that it was quite inconceivable that we should defeat Indonesia as Indonesia in a military sense and reoccupy it. I mean, they could go on sending troops to Borneo and fighting some sort of war for quite a long time, but they had virtually no internal support, apart, a little ironically, from communist organizations in the towns, but they didn't play any very significant part in it. Unlike the other anti-terrorist wars in Oman, Aden, Malaya, the civil population was never on their side, and therefore the problem was never as serious in that sense as it was in the other territories. I think Indonesia was perhaps the most successful.
So I'm going to ask you to keep it just
The confrontation in Borneo was perhaps the most satisfactory of all the post-war operations by the British Army, in the sense that it was contained with the minimum of force, it was settled decisively, and with relatively very low casualties, and with almost no disturbance or loss of life to the civil indigenous population. And in that sense, it was perhaps a model operation by armed forces in the post-war period. To me, of course, Borneo was immensely satisfactory. I'd had experience in Malaya, admittedly in rather different enemy, but a very similar jungle. And the experience of Malaya and the subsequent training in Europe and the United States had clearly been able to improve the efficiency of the regiment, and new equipment had improved its efficiency, particularly radio equipment, and training in medicine and in communications and in languages had all progressed substantially since Malaya. The result was that the sharp edge of the SAS, so to speak, was very much more effective than it had ever been before, and in an enormously difficult geographical theatre, 900 miles long, it proved possible to put into practice all sorts of things which we had thought about and trained about, like the support of indigenous tribes, arming them, raising them and training them to fight as guerrillas. There were all sorts of practical lessons from it, and the fact that it all ended in a total victory was immensely satisfying to me personally and obviously to the regiment.
And being in command, is that something, are we right in saying that's something special?
Well, yes, of course it's very special to be in command, it was very special in the sense that I'd had then 12 years off and on in the regiment and 12 years to think about it, and obviously the final 2.5 years when I was in command and therefore had control of regimental policy is an immense satisfaction and pleasure, and perhaps a very suitable moment. They say of sportsmen that they should retire at their peak. Well, I rather feel that perhaps I retired at my peak. The story of how the SAS became involved in Borneo is quite interesting, in the sense that we were still not written into operational planning, and there, as far as I know, nobody had actually foreseen the revolt in Brunei in those terms. We were not written into reinforcement plans for different theatres. I was aware of this, of course, and I went to see the Director of Military Operations in the War Office very soon after the outbreak of the Brunei revolt, and asked what service the SAS could be, where I was presumptuous enough to remind the director that the SAS had spent 9 years in Malaya in the jungle and was probably the most experienced, certainly of British units, as opposed to the Gurkhas, of any British unit in jungle, and that surely there would be some role for a British SAS squadron in the Far East.